Hello, dear listeners. What you are about to hear is our first attempt at recording 9 hosts at the same time. Not everything went according to plan. Let's just leave it at that. So the audio quality might not be as good as what you are used to. Sorry about that. But without further ado, here's this week's episode.
This is T. Earl Grey Heart, an unofficial Star Trek fan podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network. Threshold. Hello and welcome to episode 33, Mark 2 of T. Earl Grey Heart, an unofficial Star Trek fan podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network. My name is Dave, and joining me this week, as every week, is somebody who is located 5,174,285 average-sized carrots away. It's my good friend in Switzerland. It's Yannick. Hiya.
Hiya. How are you, Dave?
I'm not too bad, not too bad at all, under the circumstances. Kind of blown away by this average size carrot thing. Where did you find out about that?
I asked Google what is the average size of a carrot, and it said 7 inches. So, there we go.
Are you sure it heard carrot?
Yes.
Okay, that's fine. and also, this is a family show, be nice. And also, this week, we are joined for the first time ever by a phenomenal number of guests. We have a total of 9 people here on this video conference. So just give a quick shout out. If you say hi when I say your name, it's calling the register, isn't it? We've got Nathan.
Hello.
We've got Caroline.
Hello.
We've got John.
Hello.
We've got Ro.
Hello.
We've got Martin.
All right.
We've got Chris.
Hey.
And we've got Andrew.
Hello.
So you would have heard all of these people at some point in the past, if you've been listening for any length of time, as they have all at one point or another guested on this show. So it's absolutely fantastic to have you all here with us this week. So the reason we're doing this, because we've finished reviewing Star Trek Picard, obviously, we are now basically going to have a bit of a love fest for what is believed to be the worst Star Trek episode ever, which is Threshold from Star Trek Voyager Season 2. Caroline and I sat down and watched this at lunchtime, and I'm not sure that it deserves that particular label, but I think, Caroline, you said it was bat poop crazy, I think was the phrase you used.
Yes.
Yes, so we shall see. So I think we should just get on with it. What do you reckon?
Yeah.
Sounds like a plan. Let's start our review of Star Trek Voyager, Season 2, Episode 15, Threshold. So, in the teaser, we see Tom Paris in an experimental shuttlecraft attempting to break the Warp 10 barrier. He brings the shuttle up to Warp 9.95 when the nacelles are suddenly ripped from the shuttle and it seemingly explodes. Paris appears sitting on the holodeck floor as if nothing had happened. It was all a simulation. Harry Kim looks despondent, and Bilana Torres responds, rather matter-of-factly, "You're dead."
Yeah, it was a simulation.
Yeah. We kind of guessed it was because, well, it just seemed a bit too out there to have been something to start an episode with.
Bit too early in the episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, a bit too early in the series to kill one of the main characters anyway.
Well, that was going to be my point, because
they did kill Tasha Yar in the first season, so of Star Trek Next Generation.
Yeah, the end of the first season.
I mean, Voyager killed off half the crews of each ship on the very first episode, for crying out loud. So knocking off an odd character every now and again is absolutely fine.
But they were all red shirts, you know.
Yeah, there were loads of characters.
Yeah, you're now a target.
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I think somewhere along the path they killed Was it Arikim that has been replaced by... was it like the clone or something? I don't remember. Or someone from the alternate universe. I think that's a story like that. They killed the main character. But
lots of major characters, you know, left and got bumped off throughout the course of Voyager.
Yeah. And some came on the show and for the pleasure of the viewers. I'm referring to Seven of Nine, of course.
Yeah, I did wonder where you were going with that.
Yeah, how can you simulate... I mean, I understand the concept of the holo simulation, but how can you simulate something you don't know? How can you simulate... They're simulating Warp 10. They don't even know how to go to Warp 10. So how come they can simulate that? I don't know.
They did say that theoretical inputs that they're using. Mm-hmm. I just watched it, so I, you know...
Okay.
They have the detailed schematics and everything for the shuttle in it. So, I mean, they can theorize and project.
Yeah, okay.
And in the next scene, we learn a vital bit of information as to why they're attempting this now.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, after the teaser, you have the... rather important issue of the opening credits. Now, as somebody who didn't particularly watch much of Voyager when it was on the first time round, I have to say I found that theme tune utterly depressing.
Well, I like it.
What?
I think it's the best one.
I love that one. I think it's so Deep melodic.
Deep Space Nine is the best one, but...
I think Discovery is the best one, personally, but... you know.
Oh, God.
Discovers that Star Trek, so it doesn't count.
I think it's by Jerry Goldsmith, who wrote the Next Generation, Star Trek the Motion Picture one.
Yeah,
and I've seen him play it live in the concert hall here in Glasgow, and that is really probably his worst theme tune, I would say. You know,
I see Nate.
I think it's great.
I like it too.
It won awards.
Even the scene. Just like watching the ship go through, you know, all those beauty shots of the ship and everything. I think it's a great opener. It's a great tune, you know.
Yeah. No, I love Jerry Goldsmith. You know, brilliant Alien. You know, Star Trek the Motion Picture, Planet of the Apes was his first. You know, brilliant composer, but no, not my favorite.
I'm glad I'm not alone on that one, anyway.
Yeah. Well, so far. So good. It's not a bad episode yet.
No, yes. and the teaser was actually a reasonable size. It's not like the teaser was like a quarter of the episode. It was like, I don't know, 3-4 minutes maybe, which is kind of what a teaser should be.
It's a tease.
Yeah.
Yes. Maybe exactly.
Yeah, but, you know, with modern television and things like that, they've got to keep the attention. There's so many... stuff to watch now that you can't afford to lose someone after 30 seconds because they switched channel because they don't want to watch the opening credits.
No, exactly. Okay, then, let's jump into... Sorry, the warp into Act 1.
See what you did there.
Thanks.
Well done.
Thank you.
I give it 10 out of 10.
Oh, I'm loving this attention. This is great.
He's a professional podcaster, you know. Been doing this for years.
I give it a 9.95, to be perfectly honest.
Oh!
Structural integrity with jeopardized any
precisely.
More
so why aren't you all as considerate as Ro? Right? You all won't be dead, so... Anyway, in Act 1, Paris, Kim, and Torres go into the mess hall to consider how to fix the problem of the Warp 10. Neelix offers to help, but they don't believe that he can contribute anything to the discussion. Paris inquires if he knows anything concerning quantum warp theory and multispectral subspace engine design. Rather insulted, Neelix informs them that serving for 2 years as an engineer's assistant aboard a Trebalian freighter makes him well-versed in warp theory and demands to know what they're up to. They finally fill him in. After months of experiments, Paris, Torres, and Kim believe they have found a way to cross the transwarp threshold using a new form of dilithium they discovered in a survey of an asteroid field that remains stable at higher warp frequencies. Achieving warp 10 would allow a person to be in every point in the universe simultaneously. Sorry, that concept
it sounds very familiar, doesn't
blows
it?
Blows my mind.
It sounds very familiar, doesn't it? A la Douglas Adams.
Ah.
Mm.
That's the infinite improbability drive. That is,
yeah.
You know, you are, when as soon as the improbability drive button is hit, you are in every single point in the known universe and you decide where you're going to re-enter.
That's also the TARDIS.
Yes, Caroline
said
that.
I said that's exactly what I said when we were watching the show. When they asked the TARDIS question, everywhere? What they get, like, that would be the TARDIS.
It's everywhere.
Oh, no, it can be everywhere at any time.
Yeah.
Not that it is everywhere at any time.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, there is a basis for that in physics, and Einstein's special relativity, if you get to the speed of light, then everything else in the universe will look to you to have stopped. So that might be mm-hmm. where it comes from, but it's not warp 10, it's speed of light.
No, it's warp 1.
A good point.
Yes.
So, is it just me? When I watched this the first time round, when I watched Voyager, you know, back in the mid-2000s, I thought warp 10 was a thing that had been surpassed many times before in Star Trek. I was thinking, why are they struggling to breach warp 10 here? I've seen this done before.
The warp scale has changed between the original series and Next Gen.
Yes.
So, starting with Next Gen, warp 10 was the infinite speed that we hear here in this episode. In the original series, you could go, and I think maybe even in the movies, I think you could go warp 12 without any problems. But that was not the same as the same warp scale as modern era.
Go
ahead, Nate.
In the last episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation, All Good Things, I believe it's called.
Yes,
they went warp 13, so obviously it was a different scale. They may have shuffled the scale a bit.
They had warp 11 and things like that in the original series as well. Mm. Nomad, I believe, travelled at warp 11 to meet them.
With reference to the Nomad, I was reading online that when you look at the numbers that have been mentioned in both shows, the equivalent in The Next Generation is warp 8.6 for Nomad. So,
yeah. And in All Good Things, I think they went to warp 12 or 13 in the sequences in the future. So maybe they just took, you know, some liberties and thought that maybe in that time it would be possible to go warp 13.
That's an interesting distinction then. They didn't go beyond warp 10 in their own timeline.
No.
Right. No. Because in the voyage home, at the point they attempt their time travel, they were attempting to reach warp 10 in order to carry out the time travel, which actually aligns very nicely with this, because if you can be at any time anywhere, then they would have needed to have reached or breached the threshold in order to have done that time travel. So that, to me, aligns really nicely with that that slingshot they did.
Yeah, so probably they already had changed the scale. Well, actually, was Next Gen started when the voyage home?
No.
After.
No. Okay, yeah. So maybe they already changed the scale. But I know that in starting from TNG at least, it was not possible to go faster than warp 10.
Mm.
Yeah, it gets a bit Spinal Tap, doesn't it? With, you know, greater than 10.
Yeah.
Okay, carrying on with the review. Kim notes that getting home would be as quick as the push of a button. A problem occurs when the ship reaches warp 9.95, when microfractures appear and tear the nacelles from the ship. Neelix recalls an anecdote from his past when his ship was travelling through a dark matter nebula. Kim is initially dismissive, as it was a completely different phenomenon. But Paris realises that this is actually the shuttle being ripped from the nacelles, not the other way around. While Kim confirms the tritanium alloy hull could depolarise at that speed, Paris continues, saying that you could create a velocity differential, the fuselage travelling faster than the nacelles. As Kim infers, they could fix the problem by installing a depolarisation field around the fuselage. Paris refers to the confused Neelix as a genius and runs out to the holodeck, with Torres and Kim. It sounds like I'm drunk. I promise you I have not drunk a thing this evening. Well, not alcoholic anyway.
Maybe you should.
Because you ran out of beers.
Maybe I should. Absolutely.
I thought that that explanation was kind of silly, actually. Mm. I mean, because
yeah,
whether you have the forces on the nacelles or on the shuttle, it's the shuttlecraft, the fuselage, the forces are still there. You still have to reinforce the same part, really. Which is kind of, just from a physics perspective.
Yep, Newton's third law, exactly. Yeah, it made no sense whatsoever.
Well, you're enveloping a ship in a warp field, so physics should be mooted.
Yes, exactly.
That's a good point.
Exactly.
Magic words, magic words, magic words.
Go. Well, magic words that I'm struggling to pronounce as well, which doesn't happen.
So it's a day ending on Y.
Yeah, basically. So you get me, John.
Oh, yeah.
You get me. Mm. My quote of the week from the episode was in this. When Neelix, when they disappeared from the mess hall, Neelix then turned around and said, "I have absolutely no idea what they were talking about."
That was well done. I like that.
Yeah, nice bit of humour.
Do you not find Neelix a little bit annoying?
Oh, I love Neelix.
You love Neelix. I thought I was looking at flocks.
I really struggled with Neelix as a character whilst watching Voyager, and had to tolerate him for far too many episodes. Was quite delighted when he decided he'd found a worthy cause on a planet somewhere and decided to stay behind and not get back on the ship. It was like, woohoo!
Aww.
See, I understand. How I felt about Tom Paris. By far the least likable character in the series. I can't stand Tom.
I used to watch Voyager, and I said to Dave, "I remember B'Elanna, I remember Harry Kim, I remember Janeway, but who was Paris?" Because I've forgotten about him. Now I'll remember him as the weird one.
Yes.
What about Tuvok, though? I mean, everybody loved Tuvok. Surely.
I love him. Yeah, the thing I loved about Tuvok is almost every episode will have a line that goes something like this. You know, this was the worst episode of Star Trek ever. However, there were some good bits. Nevertheless, it was terrible. You know, that was that was a line in almost every episode he was in. And this episode didn't have Tuvok in it hardly at all, which is in my mind is a mark of a bad episode.
Yep, I agree with that. Not enough Tuvok in this episode.
Has it been awful yet?
He was a bit of a side character, wasn't he? He was just blinking you miss him.
He was there towards the end.
No, Martin, it has not been awful yet. I think it's still a good episode. I think we're not at a point where it's bad.
I would agree. Yeah, I would agree with that. It's potboiler territory still.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the end of this scene is sort of like, quick, to the holodeck kind of thing, isn't it?
That's a different show, dear.
Yes. To the bat shuttle.
The bat shuttle, yeah.
In the briefing room, the senior staff watch the holodeck simulation on the computer monitor and grin as Paris successfully brings the shuttle up to warp 10 and crosses the transwarp threshold. Captain Janeway gives Paris the opportunity to start a manned test flight in a real shuttlecraft. She says that he has the opportunity to join such great names as Orville Wright, Neil Armstrong, Zefrin Cochrane. Everyone is excited because if this works, it'll mean so much more than just getting the Voyager home. It could also begin a whole new era of exploration for Starfleet. Now, I have a problem with that last scene purely because there is an issue with the timelines being jumped in show production. Because obviously Star Trek Enterprise was produced after this happened. Had it been produced beforehand, then Henry Archer's name would have been in that list.
Yes. Good call.
I don't think he was that significant. I'm just kidding. Throw me off. No banhammer.
Come on, warp 5?
Yeah, they're trying to break warp 10, so who cares about warp 5?
Warp 5 was so last week. Yeah. Yeah, and Neil Armstrong just took a step on low gravity, you know.
Yeah, on a rock.
You could do that in a holodeck nowadays.
Exactly.
Totally trivial.
Yeah. So now, but again, I have a problem with that, is that they simulate something. So for the first simulation, okay, they had, you know, data to create a model for that. But now they're going, you know, above warp 10. They don't know what's there. They don't know what to simulate. And they don't know if what they are simulating is actually going to be true. So, yeah. It's still not a bad episode, but it starts to get a little bit weird.
But if you go back to Dave's theory about the warp 10 and the slingshot around the sun, then they would have had all the data from the Enterprise. So they would, they should have had some kind of idea of what would happen at warp 10.
It wasn't the Enterprise. It was the Bounty. The HMS Bounty.
Klingon.
The
Klingon bird of prey.
Actually, it was the original Enterprise, because that, if in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, they refer back to, was it Yesterday's Tomorrow or All Our Tomorrows? It was a Star Trek original series episode.
You're right there. All Our Tomorrows. Yeah, definitely. Where they actually, they
did it the first time.
They fall through one and wake up in 1960 something odd, being detected by radar and things like that. And they have to abduct the pilot that's observing them or something like that. And explain why they're there and all that kind of stuff, and then beam down to pick up tapes and things and recordings of them.
Yes, I remember that.
And all that. So, quite a fun episode, that.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Oh, Martin, I'm done. I'm out.
Martin, you were going to say something, Martin.
Yeah, so the thing that struck me as odd there is they went straight to, let's do a manned test flight. And I'm thinking, you have lots of technology at your disposal. Surely you send out a programmed test flight before you start sending people out in it.
Yes, but only 45 minutes for the show. So.
Yeah. And also, maybe they didn't like Tom Paris much either.
And he was wearing a red shirt.
Yes.
True, yeah.
Yeah, well, he's not technically Starfleet, is he? Because he was a Marquis Rebel. That's how he came to be on board Voyager.
Yes, along with half of the crew.
Yeah.
He was a Marquis Rebel for one day. He went on a mission and was caught and was imprisoned for it.
Well, yeah.
I don't think that really counts as really a Marquis terrorist, does it?
It's a case of bad luck.
Yeah.
You're saying he was quite rubbish as a Marquis terrorist, basically.
Oh, definitely.
No, he was just a noob.
Yeah, he's a good pilot, but that's pretty much everything he is.
Janeway enters Paris's quarters that night with news. with news that the doctor has discovered an enzymatic imbalance in his cerebellum that appeared during the holodeck simulation. The subspace stresses could kill him from a brain hemorrhage, although the chance is only 2%. Not wanting to risk this chance, Janeway plans to assign Ensign Kim to the flight. Paris begs her to reconsider, stating that people have always said that he was going to do something special someday, and that this is it. J Janeway agrees to it, and the next morning, Paris boards the shuttlecraft, now named Cochrane, and launches it. The shuttle kicks into warp, closely followed by Voyager. After running a few scans on the Cochrane's warp field at warp 9.7, Torres clears Paris for transwarp. Voyager increases to warp 9.975, its maximum velocity, for as long as it can, but Paris quickly surpasses that speed. Voyager must slow down and switch to long-range sensors to track him. As the crew waits in anxiety, Paris goes faster and faster until finally sensors record warp 10, and then the Cochrane vanishes.
Of course, because he's everywhere.
Yeah. I have a lot of problems with this, but the first one is there's a 2% chance of him having a brain hemorrhage. Surely there's a much bigger chance of the whole thing just exploding. You know?
I think it's pretty good. I think you've interesting that he started with that. My biggest problem is the way that the captain of the ship just strolls into his room in the night and he's there in his, you know, bedrobe.
Yes.
Whoosh, she's in.
That's no, a setup for later on.
No knocking, no pleasantries, just hello. Yes.
Maybe they had more rendezvous than people knew about.
You did say this isn't a social visit, as if he was a bit disappointed.
But she's the captain. She can go anywhere whenever she wants. That's her ship.
Was that the only one that chuckled when it said Janeway enters Paris's quarters?
Really? You are such a child.
I would have said, time out.
My other problem with that scene is, when you reach warp 10, you're everywhere in the universe at the same time. So why on earth are they surprised that the shuttle disappears?
Yes,
I know. I know.
It's like, come on. You know, well, Q-Fox probably stood at the back going, oh, God, I told them.
But if it's everywhere, why isn't it still where it can be seen?
Because it's everywhere.
It's spread so thinly.
It's waffa-thin.
Waffa-thin, yeah. Okay, so we are on to act number 2 of 5, unusually.
Unusually for now.
Well, unusually for us, yeah. We've normally had 4, but... Okay, act 2. A search fails to turn up the Cochrane, but then it reappears. Lieutenant Paris is still on board, but he's unconscious with weak life signs. In sickbay, the doctor scans him and observes that Paris is merely sleeping. The doctor abruptly wakes Paris, and he recounts his transwarp flight to Captain Janeway. He says that he was staring at the velocity indicator, which read warp 10, and then suddenly he noticed that he was watching himself. He could see the outside of the shuttle, the Voyager, the inside of the ship, and sickbay. For a moment, he was everywhere, with the Kazon, I presume that's how it's pronounced, yes, the Klingons on Earth. He even saw other galaxies. He says it wasn't like anything he has ever experienced. According to Paris, he only returned because he noticed that the crew was looking for him. Torres bursts into the room and says that the onboard shuttle sensors confirm that he flew warp 10, making Paris the first human to break the transwarp barrier. Paris asks Torres to download the shuttle data's core while the doctor runs further tests on him.
Yeah, can he actually see something? But, you know, he's everywhere, so probably not in any kind of human form.
Also, why did the... It says he was unconscious with weak life signs, and then suddenly, oh, he was just sleeping. You don't tend to have weak life signs just because you're sleeping.
Well, your body does kind of... go into a kind of sleep mode when you're sleeping.
I like,
but you can't confuse unconsciousness and sleeping. Not a doctor anyway.
I liked how the doctor woke him up. Wake up!
that was funny. That was good.
Wake up, Lieutenant.
It reminds me very much like the time that Bruce Willis woke up that terrorist in Die Hard. Where he sort of smacks him and goes, wake up! Do you remember that?
No.
The first Torres, one? Torres bursts in to say that he was successful, but doesn't make, you know, are you all right, Paris? you know, you're in sick bay. You thought you'd lost you, but you did the work. You did the job.
Yeah, that's Doris.
Yeah, I just let that all that wash over me as this is usual Star Trek faux science that's happening now. Just let that, you know.
Yeah, don't analyze it too much.
And, you know, I'm still thinking at this point, this is an interesting episode. I wonder where this is going.
I agree. I 100% agree.
If only you knew. If only you'd warp 10 and could have seen in the future.
See, this is where it starts falling apart for me. Because if he was everywhere and saw everything and all that kind of stuff, why weren't the Q there? You would think that's the sort of thing that humans doing would get the attention of the Continuum.
Mm. Yes, that's true.
Also, why didn't he see what was going to happen?
Yeah. Also, if he was everywhere every time, he could have seen that, don't bother, you're never going to get back home anyway.
I think that they said that you were everywhere at every time. You're just everywhere now. So you don't grow, a vision.
Oh, okay. You're at every point in the universe at that
Gotcha. Time. Okay.
It's not like the TARDIS, as somebody was mentioning earlier, because the TARDIS travels in time and space, where you are only traveling in space at this point, aren't you? There's no actual time dilation as such.
But you're still only capable of observing one thing at a time. I struggle with the idea of being able to see all of the things that he mentioned in the previous scene at the same time. Unless he did them in sequence, because you can only see one thing at a time.
I think that's the case, because I mean, if you saw everything at the same time, the existential terror that you would have in your mind,
right?
Yeah,
yeah,
would just send you completely insane.
Yeah, we couldn't cope with that.
See everything at once.
Yeah,
but I'm also picturing
you would see your own death, wouldn't you? That's one thing you would see. Yeah,
yeah.
No, you wouldn't. You would see everything that's happening at now. That point.
Mm. Now.
Yeah. Now.
Mm. Okay.
Now.
I've got images now. Of the...
so on.
Now. I've got images of the architect's wall of monitors in the Matrix series.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be a closer analogy, I guess. Yeah. Yeah.
But you mean series of Matrix? There's a series of one.
No, as in the Matrix trilogy, I meant.
Yeah, it's really not the trilogy, but let's not go there.
Coming soon on the Other Side podcast network.
There's only one worth watching. That's what I mean.
Yes, absolutely. Do you know what? I'll happily review that. We'll do a single episode and release it as a podcast, do nothing else on it, just to review that one film.
Yeah.
Hey, the Animatrix has some quality moments in it. Well,
you're not kidding
watching.
There. Some fantastic... little snippets in there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We've got it. I've never seen it.
Oh, it's fantastic.
The Animatrix. It was in the box set that we got that has like 10 DVDs in it.
Did we not watch it?
No, I've not seen it.
I'm sure we did.
I've not seen it.
I can't remember it, but we did watch it. I'm sure, I think.
Yeah, but you haven't seen Blade Runner either, Dave.
No, but I've got it. I have it. It's in my stickies.
You need to hand in your nerd card.
Yeah. Mm.
How did you get your nerd card? That's what I want to know.
I'm still waiting for it. It's stuck in the post somewhere.
The email hasn't arrived.
At this rate, it's going to get revoked.
Mm.
Well, it's not actually activated until I've received it and registered it online. So it is by its nature currently revoked. Which means I can get away with saying anything.
Anything. I can still edit the
anything.
Show.
Anything. That was Cat in the Hat, wasn't it? No?
No, it was a caramel commercial.
Oh, was it? Okay, that must be a Canadian
with the
thing.
Devil.
No, there was definitely a scene towards the end of the Cat in the Hat.
Oh, the caramel commercial definitely predates that.
Anything.
Oh, our caramel adverts for the chocolate was a bunny.
Yeah.
Yeah, a sexy girly bunny.
Well, that killed it. Jessica Rabbit in my head now. Right, moving on.
She's not bad. She's just drawn that way.
Certainly, yeah.
You could say that about this Voyager episode as well.
I drew just for that.
Kim downloads the shuttle's data into the engineering computer core. Over 5 billion gigaquads, question about that, of information, including detailed information on literally every cubic centimeter of the sector. Janeway orders the data to be sent to stellar cartography for analysis and the creation of a star chart. What is a gigaquad?
I was looking this up, and I can't 10,000
quads.
Yeah.
1,000 quads.
A billion gigaquads is a teraquad. So it should just be 5 teraquads. But I don't know how... I was looking this up, and I cannot find what our equivalent would be. You know, how much a gigaquad is or a quad is compared to a gigabyte or whatever we use now. I guess because we use zettabytes, don't we, now above petabyte. Don't
we? I guess so, my guess is that means a awful lot of data.
Yes, an awful lot of zeros.
Okay. I'm getting a little snippet of information here. It may be that the quads suffix is because a lot of Federation computers use trinary rather than binary. So they would need a different measurement system.
Yeah. Still means an awful lot.
Yes, an awful lot.
A metric shit ton.
Right, I'm just going to edit this Memory Alpha article to include that as a definition.
That is the technical term.
It certainly should be the official term. After being released from sickbay, Paris is in the mess hall with Taurus, where they are planning another flight to replicate the results of the first test. He begins to say the shuttle's memory core should be increased when all of a sudden Paris feels ill. First, he has a sip of Neelix's new Paris Delight blend of coffee and says it's awful, although Taurus says it smells all right. Then he experiences a stomach ache and then collapses to the floor, writhing in pain. Taurus asks the transporter room to beam him to sickbay, but they respond by saying they can't lock onto him. His pattern keeps changing. Taurus then calls for medical assistance and tells Paris to hold on.
Because that's what you say to someone who's in pain. Hold on. Help is coming.
Just before you say, it's going to be all right.
Yeah.
You're fine. It's just a stomachache. It'll pass.
Or, are you okay?
Isn't what they said in Alien before the alien actually gets out of his stomach?
He just needed a good meal, that's what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, those little weird vein patterns that were on his head as he was kind of rolling around the floor, having seemingly quite a bit of fun. They were really weird. I'm sure I've seen those somewhere before, actually, somewhere else in the Star Trek universe.
Well,
but it might just have been a reuse of a previous effect.
As Roe mentioned last time and the time before, they're reusing stuff a lot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Reuse stuff all the time.
It's like the whole plot line of this is really like where No Man Goes Before, the second pilot in the original series, where they tried to go to the edge of the universe and then people got superpowers and stuff like that. That's what it reminded me of that a bit.
Mm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely sort of going beyond something, you know, beyond the galactic barrier and beyond warp 10, you know, there's always, you know, there be dragons kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just quickly dropping back on the repetitiveness of certain effects and visuals. I've lost count of the amount of times the same Klingon bird of prey has been the same scene of a Klingon bird of prey exploding was used in the original series films.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are at least 3 films where exactly the same scene was reused.
Yeah.
But there again, they were like 2-3 years apart from each other, weren't they? So if you're watching it in a a movie binge, you're more likely to spot it.
It was definitely used in Undiscovered. The one that I remember is the one that was used in Undiscovered Country, and then it was used later on in an episode of TNG.
Oh, right. So they used it in the series as well. Mm. Okay.
Mm.
Yeah, why not?
Well, exactly. Exactly. There was a TV show, I think it was called The Highwaymen, and it used the same set as the inside of the NORAD complex in War Games. You know, the mm-hmm. bit with all the screens and the white borders around all the screens. It was used in a TV series in the 1990s, and it was so obviously exactly the same place, even though it would have been, I would say, upwards of 10 plus years after that fact.
I mean, that's almost as bad as the old Spider-Man cartoon that used the exact same plots, exact same backgrounds as one of the Rocket Robin Hood cartoons, and just substituted out Rocket Robin Hood and Little John and stuck in Spider-Man.
If you can get away with it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, think of the money they're saving.
The Dementia 5 episode.
Yeah. Saving money.
Mm.
It's more environmentally friendly, you know. We're not trashing sets.
Yeah, and then you can pay your writers a little bit more so they can come up with some good ideas, which obviously didn't work on this episode of Voyager.
Right.
Yeah. I'm sure that acetates in the mid 20th century weren't biodegradable, so you're helping save the environment as well.
Yeah.
Okay, we're on to Act 3. We're actually bashing through this a lot quicker than I'd expected. Oh, can you please put your mind out of the gutter? You're disgusting. I'm so glad this isn't getting edited. Ladies and gentlemen, the real Caroline. So in Act 3, the Doctor examines Paris in sickbay and says that he's had an allergic reaction to, of all things, the water in Neelix's coffee. In fact, Paris's entire body is mutating and his lungs are no longer processing oxygen. The Doctor replaces the atmosphere in the surgical bay with 80% nitrogen and 20% acid dichloride. Paris can now breathe, but a bigger problem has also developed, that he's suffering from cellular degradation and is consequently dying. And
go ahead,
it was
Nate.
During this scene that I remembered that the Doctor was a hologram.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, why do you keep going in and out of that area when you can't... you don't realize.
Acid dichloride? Is that really? You're going to come up with some better techno babble than that?
Yeah,
acid,
that's rubbish.
Dichloride? I mean, really? That was, I mean, still a good episode, but not That's one asterisk.
No, I thought it was a great episode apart from that line. That ruined the whole thing.
This scene has my quote of the week. The Doctor said, he asks Torres what Paris had. She said he had the sip of Neelix's coffee, and he responds, "It's a miracle that he's still alive."
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Robert Picard was a great comic turn. He's very good.
Yeah,
he was my favourite character in Voyager. And for those of you that haven't watched Voyager, it's not coffee. The whole premise is there was no coffee on Voyager after they got flung to the other side of Delta Quadrant. So Neelix is on a constant pursuit to try and fabricate something that approximates to coffee the whole time.
Yeah.
How come the replicators can't replicate coffee?
Yeah, good point.
I don't think there are replicators in Voyager, there?
Yeah, there are.
To save power, shut replicators down.
That's true.
Yeah, that's right. Mm.
But couldn't you just replicate a set of coffee beans and then grow them?
Yeah.
They're probably sterile, though. I imagine they can't actually replicate a living
life,
thing.
Yeah, I agree.
With reference to the hatred of the acid dichloride, it's a real thing.
Is it really?
It's actually probably the most actual scientific thing in this episode.
Acid
really?
Yeah.
There's something called acetyl dichloride,
Methyl phosphonic acid dichloride.
Wow.
And what's that used for?
It's a precursor to a lot of nerve agents.
Wonderful.
Which is probably why they don't mention it.
Wow, every day is a school day.
Apparently. Well, I feel dumb, but that's okay. That's most days.
Well, not while the kids are at home.
Especially when the kids are at home.
Yeah.
Social distancing.
Stay away from me, kid.
Right. The doctor and Kes began using radiation to try and stop the cellular degradation with little success. Paris becomes delirious, asking for a huge funeral, saying he doesn't trust anyone that doesn't cry, like Torres, and remembering his childhood when he used to cry in his room. He tells the doctor that he lost his virginity at 17 in his room, which the doctor says he will note in his medical file. Paris explains he wants a pizza. He wants a pizza with pepperoni and Kavarian olives. He also wants a kiss from Kes, but she can't grant him that wish because of the atmosphere in the surgical bay. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Before he dies, he makes a last request to tell his father that he did it. I'm referring to the warp 10 flight. He tries to form another sentence, but falls unconscious. The doctor uses a neural stimulator to attempt to revive him, but fails. The doctor announces his time of death and plans to perform an autopsy in the morning. Kes kisses Paris's apparently lifeless body before she leaves sickbay.
Good call that the doctor didn't do the autopsy right away.
Yes, that would be awkward.
No, but I do feel that had you read this review before you saw the episode, which is a bit of a dumb thing to do, there's actually a spoiler in there because the use of the phrase apparently lifeless body is now giving away the possibility that actually it might not be lifeless.
You know, to be honest, watching Star Trek, it was like 100% certainty Tom Paris was going to come back to life the next morning, was it not?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
The question was how.
The episode to be final.
We never got told how he came back to life, did we? Just did.
No, he just he turns back alive and that's it.
Yeah. Well, the next scene.
The thing that got me about that is that I would have thought the doctor would say, don't kiss him. You know, we don't know where he's been. You know, we don't know where he is. He's covered in acid dichloride.
He's been everywhere, remember.
Oh, that's true. Coronavirus.
We don't know where he's been yet.
But he has been transported back into Voyager, inside Voyager? Or did he come out of the shuttle? I don't remember. But
the shuttle would have docked and he would have got out there because he was perfectly fine when he was unconscious.
But
we have
already established.
They would have brought him in. The shuttle would have been brought in by tractor beam or something.
We have already established that there are biofilters in every shuttle bay doors. You know, one time on Enterprise, we realized that, so it's probably okay. You know, just dripping with toxic gases, but no, that's fine.
Yeah.
Sounds like me. That night, as the doctor is working in his office, he hears a strange rattling in the other room. Uncovering Paris's body, he discovers him alive and well. Paris looks at his hand and then reaches up and pulls out a clump of his hair and demands to know what's happening to him. The doctor scans him and finds something peculiar. Paris now has two hearts. And immediately in my head came the line, living in just one mind.
Also, okay. He scans him and finds something peculiar. The fact that the person you've declared dead is alive and well and asking you what's going on is probably peculiar enough to not even need to scan him.
Well, you know.
Well, I mean, Paris was balding slightly at this point, which does I can see why Dave mentioned Phil Collins at this point, because
that's someone who actually got the reference. Thank you.
Two Hearts also made me think of Doctor Who.
Yep. Yes. I went down the Doctor Who road thinking, yep, we know about that. That's a Time Lord thing.
Yeah. Now, explain to me, why would a hologram sit at his desk working by typing on a computer or on a console?
Well, the Doctor's allowed to activate and deactivate himself.
Yes, but he's a hologram.
Yeah,
maybe well,
he has access to the computer.
Learning algorithms. Maybe he has to go through that process air gap to do it.
A bit. There could be an air gap in the processor, the computers. So maybe he can't do that.
Maybe.
So a bit like Data, he was sort of constantly pursuing, sort of achieving a greater level of sort of human, human characteristics and traits. And also, he was at this point, he was still confined to only being projected inside the medical bay. Mm-hmm. So he tended to carry out tasks a bit laboriously in order to sort of fill his time, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
I mean, we kind of saw something similar with the emergency enter your function of choice here holograms in Picard, where we noticed that the emergency tactical hologram was steering the ship or firing weapons in exactly the same way that Rios would have done, for example.
Oh, yes.
But I get your point, Martin, about Data, but the difference there is that Data is a physical being. The natural way to interact with technology would be through physical contact. Whereas with the Doctor, you've got a projected being who can somehow interact with physical things, totally unnecessarily interacting with physical things.
But is he interacting, or is he just like a gooey presentation of what he's doing? like the spinning wheel telling you hold on and wait is him sitting down there, a visual way of telling the crew who are human what he's doing at that point in time.
And you also, if the humans like need him, they'll it'll appeal to them, him looking human rather than and doing human things.
What she says.
Rather than just how they're going.
Okay.
And but there's physical things to do as well. I mean, sort of doing analyses and, you know, taking samples and doing things with them. Stuff that he couldn't do in, you know, offline and in.
And yeah. He's probably programmed that way. As in, to do doctory things doctory.
Thanks for the technical explanation there.
But he was an emergency medical hologram. He was only supposed to be there literally just for a few moments, sort triage the problem or whatever, and then blip, disappear again. He's been given now, he is the chief medical officer. Mm-hmm. He is, in all intents and purposes, a de facto pucker member of the crew.
Yeah.
And so being on and being available to the crew as a normal chief medical officer would be seems perfectly normal and natural. So I think that's maybe where the decision that the Doctor stays online when he wants to be and when, you know, he's there available.
And I totally get that. I think the only thing, I mean, everything we've just discussed aside, the one thing I struggle with that as a hologram, and it's the same with all of the other emergency holograms we've experienced that we've reviewed on this show previously, is that they are holographic projections that are capable of interacting with physical objects in the real world. And
yes, but holograms... The holodeck created physical things. It wasn't all.
Yes, it was. Light, it replicated light. Them. It created them. Yeah. But in the EMH environment, so are you saying that when he took his little brain gizmo and put it on Paris's forehead, that was actually a immediately replicated gizmo that he put on his head, and then when he took it away again, it was. holographically removed. I don't know.
It was a real one, and in the holodeck, the simulations can pick up stuff.
Mm-hmm. Back in the original, it's not the original, but in the Next Generation, when they talk about when they're introducing the holodeck and how it works, they talk about it being a mixture of created objects, holographic projections, force fields, and like micro tractor beam kind of things.
Yep.
So, I mean, if we're looking at, you know, he's using a force field or micro tractor beam or whatever to pick it up and move it, then that's how he's interacting.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Right. I wasn't aware of the tractor beam thing, but actually that kind of makes sense. Okay, then on to Act 4. Crewman Michael Jonas, in his quarters, covertly sends data on the Warp 10 shuttle flight to Retic, his contact among the Kazon. Although Retic doesn't believe it, Jonas sends him the entire file in an attempt to prove his worth to the Kazon Nistrim. I have no idea who the Kazon are.
Martin Richter's
aliens with bad hair.
They were the big bad wolf until the Borg turned up later in the
yeah.
Oh, so they missed them then when the Borg turned up. We like the Kazon.
I always wondered whether Jonas was named Jonas because it's close to Judas, because that's kind of what he was.
Yeah, very naughty man.
He's always naughty. That actor, whatever he's in, he's always the bad guy. An insidious little bad guy, really sneaky, suck-up-y bad guy.
He's got his face for it.
He was obsessed with Nyssa, though, wasn't he? I mean, that's the whole idea, that he was giving all this information back to the Cardassian Marquis traitor.
Yeah. I think he was also in a cop show where he was supposed to be a good guy, but he was still a cop that did things in the wrong way. I'm not saying he's typecast, but I think he's quite typecast.
Very typecast. He's got that he kind of face, hasn't he?
Yes.
But when he
goes for those kind of roles, you know, he likes him.
When he said, you said he sent the whole file, was that all 5 teraquads? Because somebody might have noticed that.
It's true. Yeah, you would have thought so. Yes.
You know, there might be a Zoom call going on with, I don't know, whatever species they were talking to. And like, well, we can't get a good connection here, you know?
Yeah, that's a good call.
Yeah.
I would think that they would notice that much data being transmitted from the ship. I mean, I can see on my router when there's a lot of data, you know, a lot of bandwidth being used. So how would that not be detected by someone on the bridge? I mean, isn't there someone in security to watch those things? I mean, come on.
Well, Tuvok's not around, is he?
yeah. He's not in this episode.
The conversation did say that he only had so long before security would detect the transmission.
Ah, okay.
Oh, there you go, ruining everything with facts again.
So
you should be able to detect that immediately.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So you can send whatever you want for 30 seconds without being detected, and suddenly you're detected. That's weird, but okay.
Why send the important parts first.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought the 5 gigaquads would have taken that long. They've got decent broadband where they are.
Right, yeah, fair enough. It's a big cable trailing out of fiber, trailing out the back of the ship.
That's how they could have found the way home. Followed the cable.
all right. Okay, then, Andrew. Here's one for you, then, Clever Clogs. Oh. How would fiber work at warp speed?
I have no idea.
Because if fiber is traveling at the speed of light and you're traveling at warp 2,
you're going twice as fast as your data.
Going twice as fast as your data is. You might as well just keep it and drop it off at the other end.
Well, that's why their transmissions are all in subspace. There you go.
Yeah, but even subspace transmissions take their time, don't they, as well?
Yeah.
Well, it depends on the series and the importance of the subspace transmission, how much time it takes.
Very true.
Very true. A little flaky there.
Yeah. If the plot requires that they speak to an admiral immediately, it'll work fast.
Yeah, that's the Riker effect we talked about last week.
Yes.
Definitely.
I did notice that Jonas didn't announce the frequency and the style of transmission that he was sending the data across on. Sorry, personal pet peeve of mine.
But he knew who he was going to be talking to, so it's all good. He didn't need to.
I mean, did he use like comma separated values or something proprietary? That's really what I want to know.
Yeah, he couldn't use BitTorrent, could he? I mean, there'd be no other people to bounce off.
Blockchain, baby, blockchain.
Although, if you did use BitTorrent, you could see if someone else was leeching off of it because you'd see them seeding it too.
That's very true.
It's a way of not necessarily secure data connections, but at least knowing if your connection's being. Anyway, let's move on. The doctor briefs Janeway on Paris's condition. He cautions her that not just Paris's body, but also his personality is affected.
He had a personality?
Yeah, apparently so. He keeps switching from his original personality to one that seems deranged. Janeway walks into sick bay to see a mutated Tom Paris lying on the bio bed behind an isolation field. Paris says he feels like a lab experiment that went wrong. She offers to help, but Paris's personality switches and he becomes furious. He says that he's glad he's changing and thinks that whatever he will become will be better than what he ever was. He demands that they stop trying to reverse his mutation. He doesn't believe anyone likes him, and, in fact, he suspects that they're jealous that he broke the Warp 10 barrier. Janeway walks away and concedes that there is nothing she can do. Paris's personality switches back again, and he pleads with Janeway to help him, but then he lashes out, hitting the isolation field in front of him. He begins to tell Janeway how small and insignificant she is when he starts to choke. He then basically spits out his tongue and smiles at her.
Yeah.
And like,
that was a freaky scene.
Yeah, that is a bit gross, that, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Bear in mind that when this was originally run, it would have been done like early evening. That would have been quite. I remember watching it when I was younger. I was like, that would have been quite.
Yeah. Yeah. My two daughters were watching this at the same time as we were, and Kara ended up hiding underneath a blanket.
Yeah, my daughter.
I have to say though, Janeway didn't look like she tried very hard. One conversation is, "Yeah, I can't do anything."
Yeah.
Star Trek Voyager can be summed up as Janeway not trying very hard.
says the guy who defends the series. Yeah, and that was the beginning of the bad special effects makeup, however you want to call it. It's getting worse from there, I think.
Yeah. Oh, getting worse, you say?
But there was a scene when he was laid on the bed and he moved and you could see the mask line.
Yeah.
That Gorin is starting to look high-tech now, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Which Gorn? Because the one on Enterprise was actually worse than the one on the original series.
Either Which one. Gorn.
That's a good game show. Which Gorn?
Which Gorn? Whose Gorn is it anyway?
Oh, awful pun.
Thank you. Later, Kes discovers that Paris's rate of genetic mutation has accelerated by another 12%. The doctor and Kes must hurry to save the last fragment of Paris's original human DNA. Paris pleads to be let off the ship. Well, they refuse. Duh,
yeah.
How are they going to pull his original human DNA out if he's already started to mutate? Surely his DNA is already corrupted?
Transporter pattern buffer?
Doctor, explain.
This is the proto reassembling an android from a single positronic neuron, I believe.
Yes.
Okay.
That's true. The doctor explained that there was still a little bit of his original DNA, human DNA, and if they could get all the non-human DNA out, then the cells would have to use the original DNA as.
I suppose they're like. Gazillions, multiple mega quads of DNA of in a human being.
Oh, no, it wasn't that. It's that they filmed his tongue lying around on the floor and just put it back in.
Yeah. It had to come in useful for something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Trying to think of a pun, and I couldn't.
Was it on the tip of your tongue?
did the cat get your tongue?
Tom Paris did.
Please stop. Don't worry, I've got this licked. After further analysis, the doctor derives a treatment. He plans to revert Paris's body back to his original genetic coding by destroying the mutated DNA using anti-proton radiation from the warp core. They have to set up the system in an hour if they hope to save him. See, if I just waited and read that line, I would have known how he was going to do it.
Well, it's an interesting treatment, you know, putting someone right in the middle of the warp core and just bombard him with anti-protons.
It didn't work very well for Spock, did it?
No, definitely not.
It seems like that, you know, they don't do like a lot of like efficacy trials in Star Trek for medical treatments. They just do it, and it seems to work. There's got to be, for a vaccine to work, you have, it's months or years of work just for one vaccine, but, Dr. Crusher or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We should do that with COVID-19. Yeah. Just skip trials, go to treatment. Right.
It's a template, isn't it? Because, we have first test flights, they're manned, obviously, and, medical prototypes. Well, we'll just try that out directly.
So many corners are cut in this episode. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, but again, it's 45 minutes.
There's one bit where B'Elanna Torres says it'll take her 3 hours, and then Janeway says, no, you've got an hour to do it, and B'Elanna just goes, right, oh, okay.
Yeah, but if she's like... If she's like Scotty, she probably had 2 hours anyway. So
exactly. Yeah, he always multiplies his estimates by 4, doesn't he, Scotty?
Something like that. Yeah.
Mm. I would do it by 10. That would be much easier.
Well, it gives you a lot more wiggle room.
Yeah.
Still a good episode at this point, though.
I can see where this is going.
Who said
Martin.
That?
As I said, the makeup started to, to be a bit.
Yannick, you keep saying that. I've got news for you later.
Okay. Paris is mutated even further. He's in a restraint situated next to the warp core in main engineering. The core shuts down to give Paris a 2-second burst of antiprotons, but it's not working. Paris begins to struggle out of the restraints. The doctor asks Torres to start a 5-second burst of antiproton radiation when a commotion is heard in the background. Paris bursts out of his restraints. Phaser fire erupts in engineering, and the engineering screen where the doctor was observing the procedure goes dark. The lights in the room start to flicker. Paris ruptures the port plasma conduit on his way out of engineering, causing power failures all over the ship. Tuvok announces a level 3 security alert over the comm system.
Yeah, because, there's only one conduit that serves about all the ship with energy. So just rupture one conduit and the old ship goes away.
They were trying to treat him, but, putting him next to the warp core seems the safest thing to put, for somebody who's mutating under... strange conditions.
Yeah, I don't think they filled out a risk assessment for that, did they?
Yeah.
Cutting corners.
This entire episode would have passed an ethics committee, but...
No, that's fair. It seemed very obvious to me that that Paris was wearing a mask or a prosthetic in that particular scene when he was in the restraints and he was like wriggling backs and forwards. You could see the mask, his actual face underneath it.
Yeah. But, cutting budget.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I thought the scene, they were watching the monitor and then they saw the commotion was all off camera and then the the phaser fire went across the screen. I thought that was all a bit comedy, that we're going to see like Paris tiptoeing out, you know, out of engineering. It just seemed, it just seemed a bit ridiculous. I don't know what
it
was.
The phaser bit looked a bit like lightsabers going across the screen as well.
Yeah, it just, it didn't work.
We should try and put the Benny Hill music on top of this. I'm sure it would work.
Oh yeah, Yakety Sax would work well. Yeah, nice. Definitely.
So how do you know about Benny Hill if you've never seen a Low Low?
We had Benny Hill on French TV.
You did?
Yeah. Oh,
but not a Low Low stream. No. I wonder why.
We even had Benny Hill in Canada, so.
Huh? That surprises me really, because Benny Hill is a very British humor, very British characters. And I don't know how that would translate, or, well, not necessarily translate, how other people in other countries would associate themselves with.
Isn't inappropriate smut a universal language?
Yeah.
Right, so we're on to the final act, which is clearly the best part of the show.
Is that first sentence? You're going to do that and I'm going to not snicker.
Okay, let me get this out of the way. Janeway is on deck 6 outside a turbo lift when Paris attacks her from behind. And she's gone.
Yeah.
Don't invite her to this again.
All seriousness, it's a great opportunity to point out that I think Kate Mulgrew's acting was abysmal.
Yes.
I don't know whether that holds true across the whole of Voyager, but that particular scene when she was attacked and she kind of fell to the floor, I was like, you know, have you even been to Drama Academy or anything?
167 episodes of terrible acting.
And Dave, you're going to now be in that thing to show us how it should be done. Because you just said how bad it was that she did it. I want to see how you would tackle it.
Ah, hold this though. Because when I reenacted, when I did that, I did it so well, and that proves how good of an actor I am. I have nothing to prove. Right?
She didn't go when she did it.
Maybe we should.
I hope somebody's recording this soon. I really do.
Yeah, I am.
Should we all do it at the same time and see what happens?
Right. Three, two, one.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is going to Twitter.
If you are listening to this on the podcast, if this actually survives the edit into the podcast, then really, you are missing out.
It was Dave's fault.
It's always Dave's fault.
Yeah, it seems to be. Although if Poppy was here...
It would be Poppy's fault.
It would be Poppy's fault. Mm-hmm. I did invite him to come onto the show and he was like, don't you Star Trek.
Yes, he contacted me earlier and he said, are you going on the Milky Coffee Hot podcast?
Oh, I
hate him. I really do. Right, let's... what?
Is attacked from behind. Carry on.
Oh, okay. you're still lingering on the attack from behind, are you? Okay. She manages to fire her phaser, triggering the internal sensors, but they are malfunctioning.
Malfunctioning?
Yeah.
Malfunctioning.
But they are malfunctioning due to the power failure. Consequently, the bridge can't localize her exact position. However, Kim is able to report that the captain is between sections 21 and 27 alpha.
Hold on. How can sensors not work well enough to not being able, you know, to localize the phaser and just have between deck 21 and 27
signal triangulation?
I mean, it's a com badge.
Yeah. Okay. Moving on.
Chakotay orders Tuvok security personnel to that section of the ship, but is too late. Paris takes Janeway to Shuttle Bay 2 and launches the Cochrane. The shuttlecraft immediately speeds to warp. Just then, main power on Voyager is restored and the ship heads.
How convenient.
Oh, yes. It just so happens that, yeah.
It just happened that it's right after the shuttle leaves.
Yeah, absolutely. Voyager capably follows the shuttle until it reaches warp 9.975 again. Chakotay pushes the ship's acceleration even more, but slows back when the main computer issues a warning that Voyager's structural integrity will fail in 45 seconds.
That's quite specific.
Yes.
It's also it's not always 47. Specific numbers and particularly random number, isn't it? It's like 12 seconds and 45 seconds. And, you know, we've discussed on this before. Why isn't it in decimal figures? And why isn't it on a big screen, sort of like counting down or whatever? Never is.
I would have accepted 42 seconds, but...
Yeah, but I mean, the smaller the number, the more acceptable it is, because 45 seconds, you can make a really good estimate, a calculated estimate that it could happen in 45 seconds. But as we've mentioned before, on the Wrath of Khan, warp core breach in 5 minutes. But that was just a figure that was plucked out of the air by LaForge. How do you know that warp core will occur in exactly 300 seconds?
Because it's in the script.
Yeah.
That's educated guess.
Is that good?
It came up in his visor.
Overestimating, obviously.
Yeah. Where did I get to?
45 seconds.
She took it from behind.
Oh, yeah. Meanwhile. Chris and Janeway, meanwhile, cross the transwarp barrier, becoming no longer visible from Voyager.
Oh, right. That's all right.
Ta-da!
Yes.
And now, the conclusion.
Yeah, you should send that to Alex Kurtzman to see if he will use it on one of the upcoming
episodes. Yeah. Mm.
So... it's at this point that it's all been good so far. We are but moments from the end of the episode.
Yeah.
Correct. I look forward to your opinions and the opportunity to ignore them.
Specific part, but I'll wait till that bit comes up.
Okie dokie. As I go through this, if you have something to say, just say it. I'll stop. After summoning Tuvok and Chakotay to sickbay, the Doctor observes...
Hold on, you've skipped that. You need to do the first officer's log.
No, I don't.
Because that shows it went 3 days to locate.
So, Chakotay issues the following log. First officer's log, stardate 49373.4. It's taken us 3 days to locate the shuttle. It appears to have dropped out of transwarp in an uninhabited star system.
Can you drop it that close?
They could be anywhere in the universe, but you know they were just 3 days away.
Yeah,
that's like the universal equivalence of spitting distance.
Yes.
Yeah. Very true. Different.
After summoning Tuvok and Chakotay to sickbay, the Doctor observes that what happened to Lieutenant Paris was an accelerated form of natural human evolution that would otherwise have taken millions of years. It is possible that Paris shows an advanced form of human life. The Doctor comments that the life form isn't very attractive, but he is still confident that the anti-proton radiation will work to revert Janeway and Paris back to their original human DNA.
That's the turning point of the episode right there.
Yeah.
The wheels have come off. The thing I struggle with here, and now let's plow on. We need to get to the next bit before my real struggles start.
Yeah, it is going to be okay. This next one,
because so far you didn't have any struggle with this episode.
No, it's typical Star Trek fare up until this point.
All right,
here we go. Kim reports from the bridge that the ship's sensors have located the Cochrane on a remote planet in one of the jungles near the equator. Very specific. Chakotay and Tuvok beam down with an away team to investigate. On the planet, they see two amphibian-like beings. Chakotay checks them with his tricorder and finds traces of human DNA. The two have apparently reproduced, as there are several juveniles of the same species nearby. Chakotay stuns the two adult creatures with his phaser and brings them back onto the ship. Chakotay has no idea which creature is Janeway, however, Tuvok notes that the obvious deduction is that Janeway must be the female.
But that's actually very telling. They've assumed that it was the female that gave birth to the juveniles.
Well,
it could be a species where the male gave birth to the juveniles.
No, that wasn't the implication at all. It wasn't about the female would have been the one that gave birth to them. It was just to identify which was the female in order to associate.
But that's
which
also
one is
assuming that
Janeway.
One was male and one was female.
Yes.
They may have both been the same.
That's fair.
In the previous scene, the doctor explains how what's happening is a representation of millions of years of evolution in just 24 hours. And now we're presented with what is the most basic life form that first struggled out of the ocean onto land as a representation of millions of years of evolution. And it was like, how did you write those words? And then in the next scene, come up with this conclusion. It's mental. Also, amphibians predominantly live in water. Did he not have an allergic reaction to water in the early stages of this metamorphosis? It just goes so catastrophically wrong here in so many ways.
Why was there a random jungle?
Yeah.
It was Dagobah. Did you not spot?
Yes, it looked like Dagobah. That's true. And yeah, for an advanced form of life, they didn't, fight back. They were just standing there and they got stunned with a poor, just the basic
I don't
feather.
Think they could do anything. There was they were just giant slugs, really, weren't they?
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's what you evolve into when you have no, like, real pressures, no predators. I mean, millions of years of evolution happened on a secured spaceship where nothing could happen. So...
I think if I wasn't married and didn't have kids, that's probably what I would do.
Abe, I hate to break it to you.
That's three. Why weren't Chakotay and Tuvok wearing oxygen masks?
Because it's a class M planet.
Duh. Then how were the amphibians able to survive in that environment?
Millions of years of evolution.
So they go back, so after billions of years of evolution, they go back to being amphibian type things and breathing.
Got nice gills structure on the outside of their body. I mean, it's just so wrong.
Okay. I think what happened was they didn't storyboard the whole thing out and they probably forgot about that part toward the end of the episode and they just kind of glossed over it. That's what I think.
It got
really
lost
happened
of all the extra detail that was needed along the way.
Well, right. this kind of leads towards something that we've observed so many times in Star Trek episodes, where, and this actually probably falls in line with what you're trying to say, Martin, in that they have a lot of reasonable quality, comparative quality, and storyline, and the building up of the story for the first, 90% of the episode, and then they cram everything else into that last 10%, and you walk away from it thinking, meh.
Next thing you're about to read out, as a mum, I had real problems with.
Well, I have something to say on that anyway, but Martin, I'm guessing you haven't finished.
For now.
Actually, I do have a question, though.
Oh, go.
In the original, in The Next Generation, they had talked about Wesley evolving into the next form of humankind. Mm. Does that mean he would have turned into the slug eventually?
I thought they turned into energy beings. I thought that was pretty clear from the original series.
Exactly.
Wesley was at Deanna and Riker's wedding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was a good few years after TNG when he left with the Traveler. Mm. So... he didn't evolve that much if he went to the wedding of Riker and Troy.
It was not trying hard enough.
Well, I've got one more issue with that whole scene. Why did they shoot them? What was the point in shooting them? They didn't look like they were any threat, did they? They might,
no.
They might dribble on you a bit.
I bet they were a bugger to pick up if they were conscious.
It was just zap, zap.
They were quite moist.
They did look rather moist, yes. But we don't know what their defense mechanism might have been if they had been approached and attempted to pick
them
up.
Well, they were approached. They beamed in right in front of them.
It just kind of sludged a bit.
Perhaps it's something they've wanted to do anyway was to shoot them. And so they just kind of did it because they knew they could get away with it at that point.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, crap. They're not a threat. Oh, I'll shoot them anyway.
This is the only time I'm going to shoot the captain.
Right. I won't remember this.
But Chakotay didn't apologize to Janeway at the end to say, look, I'm sorry for shooting you. Because in the instances where we've seen in previous reviewed episodes, like when Trip shot Archer or stunned Archer in order to maintain cover, he then went and apologized straight afterwards.
Yeah, and Tom Paris apologized to Janeway for not shooting her, but the...
Well...
Yeah.
Although we're not there yet.
No.
No, that's not preempted.
No. Okay. First officer's log supplemental. We've transported the captain and Mr. Paris back to sickbay. As for their offspring, I've decided to leave them in their new habitat.
I mean, that is just cruel. You don't know if they can fend for themselves.
But you've just orphaned them.
Yeah.
Also, you've just left millions of years of human evolution laying on the...
Ooh, I think the head is dropped off, or is it me?
I'm still here.
Yeah, we're still here.
We can still hear you.
Yeah, I can still hear you.
I can still hear you.
Yeah.
But why would they leave the baby? I mean, they don't know whether they're able to look after themselves, what the implications are. You've literally just abandoned three defenseless, potentially defenseless animals.
Yes.
But, you know...
And I think it breaches the Prime Directive as well, quite a bit.
Probably would do.
Yeah. Well, and I think a lot of people must have complained about this at the time, because in a later episode, they circle back to this when they encounter a lizard-like species, and Tom Paris goes on this whole thing explaining about how common lizards often abandon their young.
We have lost row.
He'll be back.
Yeah.
I think this actually supports the Prime Directive, because the three offspring would have been native to the planet, whereas Chakotay and Paris weren't. So actually, by taking Janeway and Paris back and leaving the three where they are, actually complied with the Prime Directive.
But had Paris and Janeway not evolved into million years of things, gone to that planet and then procreated, there would not have been any things to be the right thing to that planet.
No,
the Prime Directive is to protect the life that's or and the evolution of indigenous life, is it not?
Yes.
So they're not really taking that into account.
No, I guess being with their parents would supersede the fact that they were born on this planet.
Well, there are how many? Yes, because you'd have to let the species do things the way they would do it, rather than making that decision on their behalf.
Mm-hmm. There are how many thousands of years from Federation space? No one's going to check up on them.
Yeah,
you know, they can just let that go.
Yeah. That's got to live in their conscience, though. They've left three babies behind.
It's in the log, though. It's not as if they've kind of like kept it quiet.
Well, that they should just. You know, redact that out of the log or something.
Yeah.
They should just redact this episode.
What should happen is an episode in the future, three lizard-like creatures come to wreak its revenge on its mum and dad that abandoned them when they were babies.
Yeah. Star Trek The Revenge.
Yeah. Star Trek Lizards.
Sporting all the superpowers that millions of years of evolution has blessed them with.
Yeah.
And it would still be better than this episode.
Just the last 4 minutes of this episode. They could have literally done anything else in the last few minutes.
I still got redeemed this.
Sure.
Okay, so we're actually up to the final scene of the episode, much to some people's happiness. Paris and Janeway are reverted back to their human selves using the doctor's antiproton treatment. Afterwards, Paris is extremely embarrassed about having mated with the captain, although he says he hardly remembers the whole event, which I think is just rude. Janeway accepts his apology, but admits that she might also have been active in the mating process. She may have even been the one who initiated it. Janeway puts Paris in for a commendation for his achievement. Context is king here, people. I presume this is referring to the achievement of the Warp 10 flight, not the achievement of the mating process.
That's what she said, but I think she was genuinely saying to him, well done for getting me pregnant as a mutant slug and giving me babies. I don't know.
Wow. I really don't think so.
Yes, Tuvok tried, but he couldn't do it.
Yeah. I was expecting her to wink, like it's an award, yeah. It's a good shag award.
If I was the captain of a ship and one of my subordinates had kidnapped me, turned me into a mutant slug, made me have babies, I don't think accommodation would be the first thing on my mind.
No.
Yeah, as Nate said, redacting the log was the correct thing to do, not give accommodation.
Yes.
Exactly.
I would want a paternity test.
Maybe he was just really good.
That's what I was trying to think, whether that was what the commendation was.
This conversation
memories of
was...
the event than he did, and she remembered how much she enjoyed it. So that's what the commendation was for.
No, she says she might have also been active in the mating process. Maybe she hasn't got much of a memory of it either, which means he's not that good.
Or she knew more than what she was letting on.
Martin, you were
not
saying
as good as a wink to a blind man.
Yes.
Martin was saying something, and when you
I just found this whole conversation far too matter of fact considering what had happened.
It was far
too jolly and upbeat. It was just the wrong tone entirely.
You'd think they'd be a bit traumatized, wouldn't you?
Just a bit. Because they've both seen all of creation spread out before them as well, because they've gone through transwarp, a second time for Tom, first time for Janeway, and, you know, turned into a whole new specimen of life. It's just mental.
And why weren't they angry at Chakotay and Tuvok for leaving their babies behind?
Yep.
Yeah.
Can you imagine the child support on that? I mean, that's insane. No, that's probably why. I mean, they don't want to have to deal with that.
I mean,
at a lizard orphanage there on the planet. It's fine.
The paperwork? No, it was not worth it. No.
Can we call those court proceedings? I mean, come on.
Hypothetically speaking, could they have turned the young back into humans?
They probably couldn't find child actors cute enough to get
They would have had to have had their own DNA.
They had their parents' DNA.
But they had the parents' DNA, and they said there was still human DNA when they scanned the slugs.
Yes, but could you separate the human DNA of a pair of hybrid DNA parents from the offspring?
Yes.
I don't know. I'm asking, could they have?
I'm not the geneticist.
And it honestly is probably the least crazy thing in this episode.
They could have probably rescued them and scraped the DNA and created one perfect human child and left two.
Maybe that's Wesley.
White children.
Yeah.
I have to give the doctor kudos for restoring Janeway with her, one of her signature hairdo. Perfect. I mean,
although she had a ponytail as well, which I've not seen her in before.
Very well.
No, she was adjusting her hair. That was when you saw her. She was adjusting her hair, so the doctor hadn't got it quite right, which I thought was pretty cool of him.
Preparing her hair so she could go speak to Paris again after, you know.
I would have been counting my fingers and toes, not arranging my hair.
Yeah.
The Star Trek Enterprise had a hairdresser, didn't they? They had Mr. Mott, who was the hairdresser.
Oh, no.
But there isn't one on Voyager, is there?
I don't think so. And yet she keeps changing her hair every episode.
Voyager wasn't the luxury liner that the Galaxy Class Enterprise was, that's for sure.
That's true. It's only a tenth of the crew.
Yeah.
Something like that was 130 odd in on Voyager and over 1,000 on.
Yeah, that's true.
That's because they lost over 50% of the crew in the first opening, in the first two episodes.
Yeah. To
include the barber.
Yeah.
Including the barber.
So they should all be pretty hairy, but you know, after a year of not having the haircuts, should all be like kind of like Klingon-y.
Sure, there's an emergency barber hologram that they can call up in the holodeck or something like that. You know,
maybe the doctor has a sideline.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Have you seen his hair?
So cranky.
Mind you, Mr. Mott didn't have any hair, did he?
Maybe La Sirena has a emergency hairdresser hair, hologram.
Yes. An EBH. Emergency barber hologram.
Yeah.
Well, unless anybody else has anything to say about this episode.
Yeah, well, I know we publicized this as the worst ever Star Trek episode, and I've said many times that I thought it was not very good. It's not that bad, actually.
No,
I remembered it as a very very bad episode, but it's not that bad. I mean,
maybe a worse episode.
The memorable quotes it said. Captain Janeway to Tom Paris. I thought about having children, but I must say I'd never considered having them with you. Yes. So she had maternal instincts and she still let them abandon them in a planet.
Yeah.
Well, she just said considered.
Mm-hmm. I considered
going to McDonald's, but I haven't. You know, same thing.
Can you think of an episode worse than this one?
I'm trying to think of one and I...
I'm finding
it difficult.
I think one of the first season of Next Generation. I need to go back and watch them, but some of them were really really dire. Yeah. I thought.
Well,
yeah. You're talking about the whole scape of things. Okay. There are less memorable episodes than Star Trek Voyager, and there's quite a number of episodes sort of around season three which feel like a bit of a grind and they're instantly forgettable, so consequently nobody's claiming they're the worst, but this had a lot of good qualities and it is memorable for the wrong reasons, but it's not the worst episode. It's quite possibly the worst 4 minutes of Star Trek. But the actual episode leading up to that point had quite a lot of opportunity and promise. It could have been something fabulous, but it wasn't. It was terrible.
On Memory Alpha, Tom Paris's profile, gender, male, species, human, children. One daughter, Miral Paris, and three hyper-evolved offspring.
glorious.
I think what makes people refer to this episode as the worst one is the fact that it's not really a good one. We all agree on that. But it's also, as you said, Martin, a memorable one. So, yeah, the others, you just forget about them. And so you can't refer to them. This one stays as the... I would re-qualify this one as the worst memorable episode of Star Trek.
Yeah, maybe. So, okay.
You say it's memorable, but I saw this episode, definitely saw it the first time round. But the only thing I remember is the end, because I think it is so bad.
Yeah, that's why we remember this episode. That's why I thought it was a very bad episode from beginning to end, which actually it's not.
When I was at university, there were some art students there. And one of the things I learned from the art students is that good art will provoke a reaction. People will either hate it or love it. And I feel like this is an artistic episode because you can't not have an opinion about this episode. You know, the fact that, you know, you search on YouTube or, you know, blogs around the world, this is often cited among the worst episodes of Star Trek ever, often the worst episode. It's memorable, but it's had some other interesting side effects, sort of outcomes. So
Yannick, you were saying about how dodgy the makeup was.
Mm-hmm.
This episode won an Emmy in 1996 for outstanding makeup in a series. Oh,
brilliant.
And it was specifically this episode that won that. And I only know this because I've got the box set of Voyager that I bought some years after, you know, they'd originally aired, and it's full of, you know, other stuff.
Mm.
And a few years ago, a biologist who had found out there were dodgy scientific publications where you could effectively pay for your papers to get published, wrote a whole thesis using this episode as the sort of the background, and got the paper published via not reputable scientific journal. So, you know, the cultural impact is definitely there. It must be one of the great, you know, science fiction episodes, because you know,
and we're sitting here discussing it.
Yeah,
right. Another podcast talking about it.
We went to the trouble of doing that twice. So it is memorable. It is one of those episodes that we will, I guess, ever remember. Even if we don't remember the whole thing, but only the last 4 minutes, but it will stay in our memories.
A couple of things I've just spotted here. Apparently, when this episode came out, Star Trek Monthly magazine scored this episode as 1 out of 5 stars, defined as total gach.
Total gach.
I wonder what Klingons would have thought about the Offspring if they saw them.
Well, they probably would have turned them into gas
or something. Yeah.
So in the director's comments on the DVDs for this, I think it starts with, "Oh no, this one's a real stinker."
Martin, I have a question. Did you actually rewatch the DVD for this episode, or do you know that?
Actually, I watched it off Netflix because I don't have a DVD player anymore.
Okay.
And also in the book Star Trek 101, it states that of the entire Voyager series, this one episode is the one most likely to give Darwin a migraine. I just love that quote.
All right.
Okay, then. So I think we're probably done. So that concludes our review of Star Trek Voyager Season 2, Episode 15, Threshold. Thank you to everybody who has downloaded our previous episodes. You can help us make the world more aware of our existence by thanking every member of your country's health services on our behalf. Or if you think that it might be a bit easier, just simply share the address of our website on social media.
Our website is located at teargreyhut.org, where you can find our show notes, our reviews, leave a comment for every episode, and find that very outdated page with the 7 questions that we ask to our new guests that I still haven't updated.
If you fancy traveling via warp 9.975 into the dim and distant past, you can send us an email. Our address is feedback@teargreyhut.org. We do enjoy reading your feedback when you send it to us, and unless you tell us otherwise, we may well read your feedback out on the show.
We are also on Twitter, Facebook, and Telegram. We are at TEGH Podcast on all those networks. You can follow us on Twitter. You can join our Telegram group during the week, where we talk about Star Trek mainly, and sometimes about something else that's totally unrelated. If you want to be notified when we record our show, Telegram is actually the only place where we're going to publish the link to our very secret YouTube broadcast.
Thanks, as always, to Memory Alpha. We have based our review of this week's episode on their work, and this is released under a Creative Commons by attribution, non-commercial license.
The rest of the show, unless otherwise stated, is released under a Creative Commons by attribution share-alike license, which means you can do pretty much whatever you want with it, as long as you credit us as the original authors. And if you publish something based on this episode, you have to release it under the same license.
This podcast is a part of the Other Side Podcast Networks. The good chunk of the hosts of that network are actually present with us on this episode.
Yes.
So we are all absolutely awesome. You can find more of our shows over at otherside.network.
Our next episode will be a review of Star Trek The Next Generation Season 1, Episode 1, Encounter at Farpoint.
Yay.
And we may not be joined by any guests since we haven't started planning that far yet.
And we still may be recovering from this one.
Yes, absolutely. So that brings us to the end of this show. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Thank you, Nate.
It was good to be here.
Thank you.
And I'm always up for Encounter at Farpoint, just saying.
All right. Noted. Thank you, Caroline.
You're welcome. Enjoyed it.
Thanks, John.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Martin.
Remain indoors.
Yes. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
And thank you, Ro, for the fifth time. You've got the world's record of number of participation to this podcast.
I certainly need to wash my... He does. I do. He does. I just touched myself as a third person. Oh, God. I really need to wash my hands of this episode.
We will be back next week with a whole bunch more of Star Trek. In the meantime, wash your hands, stay inside, and take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye.
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 Three, two, one,
engage.
Engage. Whoops.
Oh. Wasn't me this time.
You've been listening to a member of the Other Side Podcast Network. Find out more about our shows at otherside.network.